Hello and welcome to episode 335 of the Mark and Me podcast. As always, I'm your host Mark. Now joining me on today's episode is the writer and director Jeremy Saulnier. You may know him for the absolutely incredible revenge film Blue Ruin, easily, in my opinion, one of the best revenge films ever made. Also, he did Murder Party, Hold the Dark, and one of the greatest films which we're really going to focus on today, Green Room. This film's just been re-released by the amazing Second Sight, and as always, they've put their heart and soul into this release. It's absolutely stunning, and it's an honour today to be joined by one of my favourite filmmakers in the business, Jeremy Saulnier. That interview will be coming up in just a couple of minutes' time, but as always, I always like to touch base and talk about my last guest. I was joined by Naomi from the absolutely amazing band Empire State Bastard. This interview blew up, the numbers were absolutely insane. On YouTube it had over 1,000 views in 24 hours, so thank you everyone who tuned in and took the time to watch or listen to this podcast. It really means the world, and I know Naomi was absolutely personally blown away as well by the amazing response, so thanks again. But today it's all about one of the best out there, Jeremy Saulnier, an absolute genius. And yes, I don't get that long with him. It's probably the most frustrating interview I've ever done because I really wanted like 2 hours with this guy. But this might be our little introduction, and I've done it before, and hopefully Jeremy will come back on in the future and we could do a much, much longer special. But for now, I'm really grateful for what I've got. So here's me and Jeremy talking all things film. So Jeremy, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today on the Mark and Me podcast.
My pleasure.
Jeremy, what I do with all people that come on the podcast is take it right back to the very beginning of your career, even as far as going back as a childhood. I'm really intrigued when you were growing up, what were those first films you may have saw, maybe as a kid in with your family or from a friend that made you fall in love with the idea of being a filmmaker?
Yeah, my story is somewhat typical in that I'm an 80s kid, and at some point I got my hands on a VHS, camcorder, the kind that was a separate video recorder tethered to a deck. My mother was in deaf education and did research. And part of that research was recording with these, these novel devices. 1984 is when I first got my hands on a camera. And I think the influences at that time were very commercial. They were Schwarzenegger movies, there were comedies, John Landis comedies, Kentucky Fried Movie, Monty Python, just skits, lighter fare. I always loved movies, but when I got my hands on that camera, I think my first instinct was to, and this carries over for years and maybe decades, maybe into now, is I was a little afraid to go for high art, or didn't even know that concept, and went for more base level humor and gags. And so I was alone and had to build my star. His name was Oscar, and sort of in a Mr. Bill vein, I would set him on fire. I would do skits. I would do all kinds of Monty Python style skits with myself and this sort of dummy that I dragged around with me. And I had a lot of fun, but you can only go so far when it's just you solo. And some other neighborhood kids, we congregated around this access to this camera. And so we soon had a little collective going back in. By 1988, we were making Mega Cop. And that's certainly the influence of RoboCop and Miami Vice and all these cool action flicks that we all love so much. And the communal nature of it was infectious. And I sort of knew at that young age that this is the best thing on earth, is to be around a bunch of like-minded friends. And back then, we didn't distinguish any roles. We just got together and collaborated effortlessly. And we took turns behind the camera, in front of the camera, explored the art of blood packs, tempera paint wasn't quite doing it. Later on, we unlocked the Dick Smith method with Kara syrup. And anyways, we had a lot of fun. And my entry, I think, to even go to your original question is the creature features.
Yeah.
Sunday morning, the beach from 20,000 Fathoms, King Kong movies. I love Godzilla films and that sort of the tactile nature, the arts and crafts of it all. I started actually before I got my hands on that camera with dioramas, fine scale modeling, and photography. So I would sort of position miniatures and use cotton balls and expand them and for explosions, and I'd paint them red in the center, and I would take diorama photos of my cobra hiss.
This is amazing.
And I would set them up, and I would just destroy them with fireworks and all these things, and I loved. That's why I'm so into like the technical side and makeup and blood effects and pyro and costuming. I just love that you can compile all these arts into one space and then archive it on whatever medium it is.
It's amazing to see, because I interview a lot of directors and writers, and obviously the more budget that comes in, people get to play with bigger toys, but it always goes down the CG route and having, blue or green screen and AI now. But I was lucky enough, I can't believe it's over 10 years ago now, when your debut, for me, your proper first film that I saw that introduced me to your work was Blue Ruin. And I think genuinely, and I said this before I got the chance to interview, one of my favorite films ever made. So gritty, so beautiful. So it was one of those films that kind of stuck with me after I saw it for a very long time. And the fact that you did it on that budget felt to me, maybe now I'm talking to you as the kid who had all these amazing little toys, but used them just then with humans and actually a set instead of cotton wool, and instead of setting fire to a little toy, you could actually use real practical effects. And did you ever expect the response to Blue Ruin that came with it? Because it really is still today looked back at as like a cult film, even though it's 10 years old.
Oh, no, I Blue Ruin will always have a special place in my heart. And it was at the time, and it still might set the high bar for I don't know as a filmmaker how often we get to have a film that exceeds expectations and aspirations. Most films are about compromise. And I think I had been working in the field, after my first film, which was more in that horror comedy vein, again, a little self-conscious about the budget level and the resources and the level of artistic exposure. So instead of going all the way and exposing myself, I was like, let's just make fun of ourselves as artists with me and my buddies and get together in one time, one place, and just have a kind of sleazy comedy that's shot on standard def video. And I was afraid to kind of really expose myself there, because I felt I didn't have the things I need to present a proper movie. Blue Ruin was a reset, because after you do a sleazy horror comedy, you get a lot of sleazy horror comedy scripts. And I love that genre, but I wanted to do more. And I was able to compile a list of these things that were in my control and within reach, including my best buddy, Macon Blair. Instead of setting fire to little toys, I could destroy him on camera. and he was game. And just built the whole thing around available resources and not bemoaning what I don't have, just inventorying what I do have and then say, well, here's a quarter of the film was already written for me, because I have this location, I have this actor, I have this general idea. And then just sat down like, well, now what would really happen if one were to encounter this traditional sort of cinematic trope of a revenge mission? Let's just break this down and make it practical, and in that practicality we'll find a movie. like the cutting room floor of most action movies is what Blue Ruin ends up being. The details, cleaning up your messes, not just leaving them, the repercussions of these acts that we sort of celebrate sometimes in movies, and myself included. Like, a good revenge flick with a great kill at the end is super gratifying. But I just felt, well, let me do what I can do and just kind of take it from a different angle. And because Macon Blair is not 6'3", 210, and can't bench his own weight times two, it was like, let's ground this. And I had come off, as far as that movie exceeding expectations, I was certainly in the trenches with my friends and fellow filmmakers, mostly as a cinematographer. So I was there after Murder Party didn't quite, set the world on fire, and I had to go back to my day job and be a camera guy. I was still shooting indie movies and really taking great notes on successes and failures, where our conversations with me as the cinematographer, with the director, where we wanted to go and where we ended up, and what part I was playing in that compromise, and being subject to actors' schedules and all these other issues that are more business oriented. And then actually engineering Blue Ruin from scratch to be like the best it could be, to be visual, less talking, to use my skill set as a cinematographer and really make it about lensing and telling a visual story with very little dialogue, and having these spaces that I was familiar with. We shot in my childhood home. We shot in Macon Blair, the lead actors. His cousins had property in Virginia, and we went there for two locations, and just sort of, I remember, like, I was emailing Macon, like, hey, Macon, can you have your dad sketch out an overhead diagram of the ranch or whatever location, and then I would just write to that. So it was this neat thing where I didn't have the opportunity to build sets and sort of create what was in my mind. But I was able to write what was available. So the script had very little translation from script to screen as far as how we shot it, which is a big sort of rift in the filmmaking process. How you have an idea, then you got to go scout. Oh man, like that door is on the other side. I thought it'd be here. If we move that and the fridge goes over here, we can't have that scene where the guy comes. It becomes a sort of rat's nest of how do we make this script work. But with Blue Ruin, it was like it was already locked and loaded. I know my childhood home. I wrote a big sort of set piece there, and I knew every inch of it. And so the blocking was already in the screenplay, every shot, every moment from the second I wrote it. So I think that was a neat little coup in obscure indie filmmakers. All of a sudden, at that time, there wasn't a lot of sub $500,000 movies in the sort of stark genre world where they weren't sleazy comedies. They weren't lowbrow. They were aiming high and zero stars. And we had some great actors, but nothing you could package and sell. And it was able to go, unfiltered, because a lot of the notes when we did try to get financing at first was it was like, how about a flashback to show what happens, and how about this, and all these standard things that, like, that's shitty. That's how you make these garbage movies that just don't resonate. So by failing to get the amount of support we needed, it really, really helped the movie become what it was, which is just a pure vision based on a very practical approach to filmmaking from notes from the trenches of indie filmmaking. Don't do this. Don't get the huge. I always wanted the Arri Alexa, the Fisher 11 Dolly, the big, fat, wonderful, highest quality gear to protect the camera department. But what I ended up seeing was, like, if you really can't afford to move that camera, you don't get anything out of it, because it's certainly high resolution, has a great color space, yada yada. But what I need is a camera that's agile enough to move with me. I had a tripod and a slider, a 5 foot little, mechanism where I could just move the camera to 5 foot span. It was a Canon C300. It was like a sort of prosumer thing, but I could do six setups in 20 minutes, getting actual dusk and archiving these things that on big movies, the first thing they say is like, if you have pre-dawn or dusk or whatever, it's just pick day or night. We can't do that. We can't move our trucks. But at Blue Ruin, oh, we did it. And when after 12 hours, you know, trying to be kind to the crew, if they had to go home, I stayed up, had an ice cream cone on the beach and got a great dusk shot on hour 15, but it wasn't a headache. And it wasn't, you know, Teamsters and union collaborators getting screwed. It was just me, and I had a blast.
It's incredible. And I thought to myself, how do you then have this success, this incredible looking film, and then top it? And you came along only a couple of years later with Green Room, and obviously a bigger budget, some of the best casting out there, some of the best acting performances you see. Does it feel like you're still pinching yourself when you get to look back at that film and just the success it has? And now obviously this will lead to, you know, Second Sight's release, but Green Room, what an absolute masterpiece of a film that you must be so proud that you've written and directed.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that was a little more traumatic. Actually, it took me years to realize what I had, because that was where coming from Blue Ruin with sort of that unfiltered nature. My wife and I were the ones that greenlit the extra day of production with zero back and forth. You know, when it rains, oh, we'll shoot another day. When it comes to a financier or a studio, there is this game you play, and it's you know, hey, it rained, we need to shoot another day. It's like, well, then you got to take this scene. It's all about like back and forth compromise. So when I wrote Green Room, it was this pure vision. The idea actually predated Blue Ruin. So I was, but it was too hard. Actually, people think to be cheap, to do like a movie that takes place over one night or people in a room talking. Blue Ruin was cheaper because when it rained, it could be raining. It was compartmentalized in these little scenes. Green Room was so contained, and I had to have total command over the space. It was all about the venue, the green room, how these things blocked out. And the idea was just like, you know, trying to do films in continuity over the course of 2 days, you're screwed when it rains. You're really handcuffed to the sort of the arc of the movie. So I came off Blue Ruin, and there was definitely, I got agents, managers, kind of beefed up my presence because I was so terrified to lose momentum. But I was getting scripts, and that some of them were good, but clearly you learn it when you first come up. You get all the scripts that had been floating around in the development for 10 years or 5 years, and they're all thrown at you. Like, these haven't gone yet. What do you think about this? So you were in 12 scripts, like, they're all pretty good. But what can I add to this? You know, what's my skill set? And after a few months, towards the end of the Blue Ruin Festival run, I panicked. And I said, fuck it, I'm just gonna start Green Room as a backup. I'm going to write what I know. This idea has been haunting me for over a decade, so let me get it out there. It is definitely my younger self as far as the voice. It is hardcore, it is brutal. It is from my youth and the punk hardcore scene, you know, in the peripheries, just kind of watching my friends and bands and that culture and going to shows in remote areas and having little shady experiences and wondering, oh shit, we're out in Manassas, Virginia at a metal show, and there's some sketchy people here, and again, no cell phones back then, and holy shit, like, what if something went wrong here? Like, we could do basically nothing. And a lot of these, I was like about 16, 17. These are grown men who could, you know, if they so chose, end us.
Yeah.
Like, oh shit. So I wrote it, and it just started to flow. I wrote it in continuity, like the opening scene, where are we? My friends had indeed been on a road trip on a tour, a little punk rock tour, and have fallen asleep at the wheel and had these things happen to them. So I started there, used people I knew as references for the characters, Tiger, Sam, you know, everybody. It was my backup plan, and soon thereafter, I got sort of engrossed in that process, and really was surprised I got a chance. I think the financiers were also brand new to the game, and because of our collective sort of, I wouldn't say ignorance, but lack of experience, that film somehow got made unfiltered. And there was pushback. There was some talk of development and explaining to them that, like, you guys, you bought the script for a production deal, not a development deal. And if you really wanted to make Green Room into Die Hard, which is a film I love, you should not have bought the script. And so there's a lot of contention going into it. We almost shut down. We were on the ropes, actually. It was my first time losing control of my film. Once you take that dollar, the film is not yours. And I fought for 30 days on Blue Ruin, and our full budget before we did all the film, the music licensing and whatnot, was under a quarter million. It was about $180,000 cash. Ended up being 415 because we chose it to be. After we sold it, we beefed it up, got the insurance, made it all, dotted the I's, crossed the T's. But here's Green Room for $5 million, and we have two less shooting days.
It's crazy.
Yeah. So I was like, what the fuck? And again, I went right into that, like, just really confused and kind of battered. I had to call my sister for therapy. I was about to quit my own movie, to be honest, because I didn't feel like we were all on the same team, and it was rough. And then, as we were on the ropes about to shut it down, one of the issues of contention was we needed someone bigger for the Darcy role. And I was like, well, we offered to several people, and I it's a weird sort of neo-Nazi role. Who the fuck is going to do this? And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Patrick Stewart just joined my management company. And fucking swooped in, saved the movie. 2 weeks later, we were shooting it, and I had to go along for the ride. It was not fun for me making it. Only about halfway through, I realized how fucking lucky I was to be with this cast, this crew. I think it was a spaghetti dinner that Macon Blair held at his apartment, where we got to finally just be together as a cast and a crew. I know we were playing the Misfits. I know people were dancing. I know I had a good hot meal that Macon cooked up. And then I said, oh, wait, this is bliss. I better take note. And all the cast, this is not that sort of retroactive bullshit. Like, they were all wonderful, every single member. And they gelled, and they carried me through that experience. But even through post, it was a little traumatic. And at the premiere, I didn't quite realize what we had, and I was so sort of shell shocked by it. We went to Director's Fortnight for the premiere and got a standing ovation. But I didn't believe it to be true, and I asked my manager to get me out of the room. I was so, like, fucked up from that, because when we did a 16 weeks of post from sitting down to premiering it, and it was just a whirlwind and lots of tumult, internally. But I think that is why the film got made. Because again, if this was put through the proper process, this would have been totally watered down. The dialogue would have been dumbed down for an audience to understand. It's like the rule was, like, the characters speak to each other. So it became a sort of esoteric thing that actually, surprisingly, resonated more by being true to itself. And so, yeah, now late, it's good timing for this re-release of the Second Sight version, because I'm excited as a fan now to watch it again, because I keep my distance from my film. Like, I lean in so hard. I know every frame. I tweak every sound effect, and I oversee the final mix, and then I had to leave. I can't watch it again. It's now for the audience, for them to enjoy or judge or walk out of, whatever it be, and I keep my distance. So, but like all films and these experiences, like, over time, yeah, it become way more special, especially after having lost Anton. That time we shared was just, priceless.
I'm very wary of time. I feel like genuinely I could speak to you for a couple of hours. I'd love to get you back on. I know you've got a lot for us to do, so there's a open door there and a ticket to say please come back on and let's talk, because the background of your music roots, what you've done on True Detective, what you've got coming up in the future, I can't talk do all that in 20 minutes. You're like one of my dream guests, so I'd love to get you back on and do like a follow-up to this at some point if that's possible.
Yeah, well, I tend to ramble after my coffee,
Well,
so.
I want to talk and talk and talk, but I'm very aware there's probably someone waiting to speak to you next. But what I do on the podcast to end this is have one final question, and any guest that comes on, and this has happened for 330 episodes, the guest gets to choose the final song that comes on the podcast. So I'm going to put you on the spot. Can you give me one of your favorite pieces of music or a song by a band that then will play as the outro to today's interview? And I am putting you on the spot. I know you have good roots of music and there's probably a thousand songs in your head, but one that you just instantly comes to your head and your heart that we'll use on today's episode.
Ooh, yeah, that's a tough one. That varies from minute to minute throughout the course of my day. Let's do Gut Instinct, Disturbing the Peace.
Amazing. Is it just because it's just a fucking great track that you love?
It's in my head right now.
Amazing. I can't wait for people to revisit this film. In hindsight, that's when you really appreciate a film. Genuinely, these films we've talked about today are masterpieces, and Second Sight will do and give you the treatment this deserves. So thank you, and I really hope that we can make something else happen again in the near future.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
So there it is. There's my interview with me and Jeremy Saulnier. And as I said at the start of today's interview, my God, he's a genius. He talks so beautifully, so much passion. Thank God for the coffee, hey? But genuinely, I was left like, I really have so much to talk about. But when they do these press tours and you have so much allocated time, you need to basically get the most information you can in that short space of time. I'm proud of what I got. I enjoyed it, but I was left frustrated because I had so much more I'd love to cover. But I do truly believe, and we've done this with Neil Marshall, Neil Blomkamp, Alex Winter, guests return, and I would welcome Jeremy back whenever he wants. As always, if you've enjoyed today's episode, please share it. The links are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and it really goes a long way. If you don't follow me on any of those social media channels, they're all on markandme.com, so please hit the like or share or follow button because it really goes a long way. I also have a Patreon account. Each and every month, you can sign up on there for as little as £2 a month. You're guaranteed at least 4 episodes every single month, but it's mostly about 8. You also get some access that no one else gets to exclusive episodes that are called the Lost Tapes. You also get a welcome pack, which includes badges, stickers, and much more, a monthly newsletter, and I'll continue to make sure there's opportunities to win some amazing prizes each and every month. Right, I've got another edit to do right now. It's absolutely manic at the moment. There'll be loads coming to YouTube, so if you're not on there and you haven't subscribed to my page, it's at Mark and Me. Hit that subscribe button and the thumbs up because that really goes a long way. And just before I say goodbye, let's give a quick shout out to the sponsor of the podcast, Richer Sounds. Honestly, I say this every time, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for those guys sponsoring me each and every month. So if you're in the market for anything with audio and visual, go on richersounds.com or go to one of your nearest stores. I'll be back, like I said, very soon with some more episodes. So until then, look after yourself, take care, and I'll speak to you all very soon.
I'm dealing out your pain. I was a truth I knew your face. Driving down to your knees.